Welcome to the Balanced Bites podcast with Diane Sanfilippo and Liz Wolf. Diane is a certified nutrition consultant and the New York Times bestselling author of Practical Paleo, the 21-Day Sugar Detox, and co-author of Mediterranean Paleo Cooking. Liz is a nutritional therapy practitioner and the best-selling author of Eat the Yolks and the Purely Primal Skincare Guide. Together, Diane and Liz answer your questions, interview leading health and wellness experts, and share their take on modern paleo living with their friendly and balanced approach. Remember our disclaimer, the materials and content within this podcast are intended as general information only and are not to be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Hey friends, welcome to this episode of the Balanced Bites podcast. Let's get a quick word in from our first episode sponsor.
Pete's Paleo is a friend of the Balanced Bites podcast, and they also are fans of the 21-Day Sugar Detox. The 21-Day Sugar Detox is great for your body in so many ways, but consistently feeding yourself right can be a challenge. Pete's Paleo makes delicious, seasonal, ready-to-eat meals that strictly follow the 21-DSD program. They're shipped directly to your door, ready to go. Let Pete's Paleo help you with your 21-DSD success, and don't forget that their bacon is also sugar-free. 5 off 21DSD is your coupon code for $5 off 21DSD meals, and 5 off Pete's Paleo is your coupon code for $5 off regular Pete's Paleo meals.
Alrighty, Liz here with Diane. Hi.
What's up?
What's up? I feel like my energy level I'm like real excited. Hey girl, what's up? And then by the end, I'm like, sign up for our email list. So this may very well be the last episode of the Balanced Bites podcast that I'm there for 100% of the podcast. We'll still be doing fertility tips and I'll jump in on some questions, still be doing the sponsorships, but I'm pretty much firing myself for the next, for my maternity leave, because if the last episode I appeared on was any indication, I think I have some pregnancy bubbles that have floated up to my brain.
I have no response.
You can't, nothing.
You like do this pause for response thing. And I'm like, no, I've got nothing.
That's actually written into our podcast document, pause for response. Look, you're not totally averse to this thing. You bought a very nice present for my boobies.
That was Haley and I.
I appreciated that very, very much. Thank you. Thank you, friend. Welcome. Friends take care of each other's fun bags. Can I say that?
I don't know, but I wanted Haley to throw in another small gift in there, and it sounds like she didn't, because I think you would have commented on it.
No, I did not see anything else in there. I'll have to go back and look. But look, you can buy me as many gifts as you want.
I might send you the other one just because I thought it was hilarious, and then we'll talk about it on another episode.
I have a baby registry, and people are asking me for it. No. Did I send you the link? Huh? No, I did not. I did not send you the link. But I think people kind of want to know what paleo, crunchy, non-toxic, obsessed moms want. I just don't know if I
want to. You want to share that with our listeners?
I'm not sure.
You'd probably finish getting everything on your list if you did.
Hold on. I got to think about it. I got to put a bunch of really expensive stuff on it first. see which listener loves me the most.
That's hilarious. Forget bringing dark chocolate to a book signing or a seminar. Now it's all about Liz's baby registry.
Yeah.
I think that the baby registry is pretty much like, it's up there above anyone sending me like pictures of a wedding dress they're looking at buying or any of that. Like people keep asking about when we're getting married. I'm like, I don't know, whenever Scott might want to plan a wedding. Like, I'm just not into planning that stuff.
And whenever Scott finds his perfect wedding planners.
Well, I think we're actually going to do a pig roast in my parents' backyard. So
I love weddings. You get to sit at circle tables and listen to the hits of today. Like single ladies.
Oh, target lady.
So many flashbacks.
The best.
So many flashbacks. All right. So what's going on with you? What's happening in your world?
What's happening?
Your judgy, childless world.
I'm not judging anybody having a child. I just don't care for children much. No, not judging it. I don't know what's going on since last we spoke because it was so long ago.
It was. It really was.
Well, I think I probably, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's going on.
Wow. Not too much. Usually you have more to say.
I know.
Usually you're better prepared than this. My goodness.
It's almost like I just told you everything that was going on.
I know.
Well, I forgot to mention, I think this is worth mentioning to anybody who lives in like the Houston, maybe even Dallas, Texas area. I have to look up where they have locations. So if you're like a paleo-ish type of person and your splurge will be something that's gluten-free, for example, which that for me is pretty much the splurge. I have to tell you all about Max's Wine Dive. I've only gone to it in Houston, but apparently there's one in Atlanta. It says Atlanta. I'm assuming that means Georgia. There's one in Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, all over Texas. It looks like there's one opening in Denver soon. There's one in Chicago. So there's in a lot more places than I thought. But Max's Wine Dive, they have a gluten-free fried chicken. Apparently the original owner of this restaurant chain, I guess it's now become a chain, is celiac, or someone in his immediate family is celiac. So they're pretty sensitive to the whole gluten-free thing. And they even have a dedicated fryer for the gluten-free chicken, fried chicken. It is so amazing that when I recently had a layover in Houston for 4 hours, I called up one of the women who's on my team, April, who's just awesome. She's the one you guys have probably heard us talk about on the show in the past, who fosters a bunch of dogs from Canine Angels Rescue in Houston, and actually Liz's dog, Scout. Is his name Scout? Her name mm-hmm. Scout? It's a girl?
Yep. It's a girl.
She was from Canine Angels, and I know Jenny, Hule, and Ben adopted from Canine Angels from her as well. Anywho, she came and picked me up from the airport. We went and got fried chicken right when they opened at 4 o'clock, and then drove me back to the airport so I could catch my plane. Not only catch my plane, but have leftover fried chicken for the flight, and also what I got to eat for lunch the next day. So that stuff is amazing. I figured I should just let people know about it. It kind of sounds like a shout out, but it's really, you know, when you eat this fried chicken, it becomes what's up with you. It's the fried chicken. So you had the chicken. You were there.
I have. It's spectacular.
And when we were touring there with Brittany and who else? I was with Caitlin and Nabil. I was telling everyone about the chicken. I'm like, we have to go there. This was like after the Costco event we did in Houston. Like, we have to go there. It's really talking it up. And it did not disappoint when we went back there. So I was like, yes. And then 4 hour layover, I was like, do we have time to go get fried chicken? Let's do it. So yeah, that's it. That's my only update. It was about the fried chicken. I'll probably regret this later that I didn't have something else to tell folks about, but that is all.
No, it's all good. There's a gluten-free fried chicken restaurant in Lawrence, Kansas. I've never been to, but whenever we go up there to go to 715, which is like the farm to table that we go to every once in a while, we drive past it and I just think it couldn't possibly be as good. And I wonder.
As Max's?
You know, because you got to be careful with it. No, it's not. It's I not know. Max. But you have to be so careful because
you can be gluten-free,
but do you trust the ingredients?
This is true. And I think the folks at Max's are pretty legit about it. Yeah. The other thing is, I forgot to mention, now everybody's like, I want fried chicken. They serve it with this, like, I feel like it's a red pepper flake honey. I feel like they put a few red pepper flakes in it just to give it a little bit of kick. I mean, it's not super spicy, but they serve this fried chicken with honey, and I just, it's amazing. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
So I think that's it.
All right. Well, there's nothing new with me. That's all the same stuff. Just trying to get nested, get prepared, get all my non-toxic stuff in place.
Get this little one grown and out.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, it does have to come out, doesn't it?
It has to come out. And then yeah. Your Facebook profile picture is going to be an infant. This is what's going to happen. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen.
You tell me what's going to happen, and then I'll tell you why you're wrong.
And then, like, every week, you'll post another picture, and it'll be like, that baby looks the same as it did last time.
But it has a different sticker on it for a different week.
I'm totally not, like, me saying that is just totally, like, I'm just totally joking around.
Oh,
like, I think it's, I don't want anyone listening to be like, that's so mean. Like, I post whatever the heck you want on Facebook. I'm not one of those people who's like, ugh, I can't believe people post that. I'm like, whatever, post whatever makes you happy. I just think it's hilarious because there was some whole, I don't know if it was a video or an article. It was a video where it was like, the, you know, non-baby person's reaction. And she was like, yeah, I saw your picture of your baby. It looks exactly the same as the last picture of your baby. But, like, our pictures of ourselves look pretty much the same every time, too. So, you know.
It's true. But let's to be fair, right? How many posts about me being pregnant have I put on Facebook? I can tell you.
Maybe one photo.
One picture.
And you didn't even say what was happening in it.
No, unless you really looked close, you can't even tell that that is a picture of me with a bowling ball in my belly. Cannot even tell. I've posted nothing on Instagram. I talked about this a little bit. I'm just not, me personally, given that a lot of my life is online at this point and knowing how terrible some people are. I mean, it's borderline criminal the way people just steal pictures off the internet. They grab them somehow and put them up on fake websites. I mean, I found my face, my freaking face, pictures of me on other websites people are trying to sell stuff through with my face and my name. And so just that's to me crazy. Putting something, it happens all the time. You mean people steal content on the internet?
Yeah, there was a Facebook page that had like my portrait as well.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, that's not my page.
Yeah. So just for me, what I share about a tiny little thing that has no choice in the matter right now is probably a bit more of a complicated matter than it is for folks who maybe don't work on the internet. So for me, I've been pretty private about things. And obviously, for people that really want the information, I'm sharing a little bit more raw stuff about my experiences and baby making beyond, but it's just not something that I'm super comfortable with. And that'll probably change when I just see how freaking adorable this baby is going to be. But
I think it's going to be pretty cute.
Yeah. You know, I was a really cute baby. I was, I like every time I go see my parents, I'm like, let's talk about how cute I was. Wasn't that cute?
I believe that.
Like some kind of validation in that. Like no matter how many times I fail in my real life, I was a really cute baby. We have photographic evidence. So that's that. All right. So we have a shout out. I'm very interested in this book, Diane. Have you read this or have we just seen folks talking about it?
I haven't read it. I actually saw Rob Wolf, no relation to Liz. I saw Rob posted about it and that was the first I'd seen. So
it's called Paleo for Restaurants. And I'm going to read a little bit about the description.
The subtitle is Don't Lose Customers When They Reject Grains and Other Neolithic Foods.
Yes, we are at an impasse in modern life where people are asking for modifications.
Please take my money and give me food I can eat.
Yes, please. Or even just keep the bread and give it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. Like, don't put it on my plate for me to throw it away. Why are you insisting on bringing me this bread? So this is just a description of the book. You'll learn what we're looking for and why and how you can provide it without breaking the bank or alienating other customers. Basic paleo cuisine isn't rocket science. If a caveman can do it, you can too. Explore how simple changes in your kitchen will help retain customers who are rethinking what has always constituted a healthy diet. It includes resources for kitchen supplies, recipe ideas, and more. Pretty cool. So there are a lot of folks out there, I think, that maybe know somebody that has a restaurant or, you know, whatnot. Maybe you tell them about this book.
Yeah, I actually tagged somebody that I know who owns this grass-fed burger place I talk about all the time called Rome in San Francisco. And they have, I think they have two, if not three locations now. And probably opening another one maybe at some point. But yeah, I tagged this guy Josh, who is a co-owner of them. I was like, hey, check it out. And you know, they're already super, you know, gluten-free friendly and all of that, but I feel like if there's ideas for restaurants to really get on board with this, I think that's awesome. And you know, they don't have to be a paleo restaurant in order to have some sort of catering to those of us who eat paleo. Now, I think what I see on a lot of menus when I travel, and I try and either talk about it, you know, I'll post a picture on Instagram and talk about it. I've been doing a ton of hashtag like practical paleo travel or practical paleo travel tips. I've been doing a lot of tags and posts like that because I realize that many people don't know about some of the, just the things that I'm used to, and they've become second nature to me as I'm traveling. And I've basically been traveling almost as long as I've been paleo, like probably a year into eating paleo, I started teaching at least some of the introductory information about it. And so right off the bat, you know, I was traveling and eating this way. So I think this is something where off of a menu right now, you can find when things are gluten-free, but for people who do have other severe allergies or intolerances like corn, or if they can't do rice, other, you know, grains like that, for example, it would be helpful to just have somebody have some basic understanding of, you know, what's a basic paleo template look like, how to let people know at the minimum when things are gluten-free, which I feel like most restaurants are on board with. You get those little like crossed out wheat picture on a lot of menus.
GFV.
Yeah, or the GF and the V for vegan or vegetarian, yeah, or strict vegetarian. So I think that that kind of is the starting point. But yeah, I think this is cool because it'll give people hopefully some more ideas. I'm actually going to do the look inside thing right now and see what all is in here. I think it'll be helpful. And that was a great idea. So what's his name? Let's see. What was the author's name again here? Well, shout out to Joe Dish. I'm thinking that's how you pronounce it. D-I-S-C-H, for coming up with that idea. Good for you.
Awesome. Very nice. So I've been watching this show now and again called Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce.
Yes! Liz, I didn't even tell you.
Whoa. Oh. You just literally blew – I told you how deeply embedded these earphones are in my ears right now.
I just – I did not talk to you literally the day I got into Salt Lake City. So I found out that the elevation does have something to do with how exhausted I was the next day. I was like, why do I just want to lay in bed all day? What?
It's climate science.
It's crazy. So from 7 a.m. when I woke up till 2 p.m., I was watching Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce on my computer. So
it comes on right after Beverly Hills Housewives. And when you record stuff on Bravo, they get like the first 5 minutes of the next show. So you get sucked into it.
You do. Well, I only watched it online because I'm like, I can't pay attention to when things are actually on the television. But okay. Yeah. So I just had to share with you that I've watched this show.
And you like it?
I find it very irreverent.
I do too. I like it. I'm really sad that Janine Garofalo is gone.
Yeah, but
I like the girl they brought back.
The other attorney girl?
No. They got rid of Janine Garofalo, and then they brought in the chick from Legally Blonde, who's like, I got bangs. My hair is so now.
Oh.
She's funny.
I thought it was that other attorney chick was the new character, but maybe I'm wrong.
She's okay. Too. But, you know, I kind of have to pay attention, whatever. And the episode that was last on, they were at some farmer's market in wherever they live, like LA. And this girl's chasing down her kids and she goes, I told you, no nightshade veggies.
I don't think I've seen that one. That is awesome.
You've got to watch it. I was like, wow, I always think here in mid-Missouri that it's like people have nobody even cares about this crap. But apparently in LA, it's just like completely normal to be like, no nightshades.
Oh.
No FODMAPs.
No, yeah, don't cook it in oil. Cook it in, you know, olive oil or butter. Don't cook it in soybean oil. I remember when we
went grass-fed butter and steam saute it.
Let me give you the butter I'd like you to cook this in. When we went to teach there a couple years ago, I remember any modifications we made, nobody looked at us funny because this was like the least of it. Like our requests were easy peasy to them. So yeah.
That was really funny. So you got to watch that. I thought you'd get a kick out of that one. Okay, so let's do a little this week slash last week in the real food paleo sphere. This is completely probably a little out of left field, but I know I've dropped a couple phrases in the last couple episodes where I talk about, well, we're looking at epidemiology versus actually identifying a mechanism. And I had somebody post to my Facebook page, someone who is reading my book, Eat the Oaks, and really loving it, and basically posted this screenshot. So I don't know that this is actually this week in the paleo sphere, but I wanted to bring it up anyway. And she basically said, so this is another one of those issues of methodology or just kind of another BS thing that we need to not take so seriously. And I'm going to read it because this is clearly from either a newspaper or a magazine. And we're going to just dissect it very briefly. This is the heading is whole grains linked to longevity. And this is the crap that we see recycled 10 times on Huffington Post, and then it's on Yahoo, and then it's on wherever. Consuming more whole grains can lead to a longer lifespan and significantly decrease the risk of death from cardiovascular disease, a new study has found. So we hear that and we think, oh, they found a mechanism by which whole grains directly clean out your arteries and make you healthier. Researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health looked at the dietary habits of 118,000 Americans who participated in periodic health surveys over 25 years. They found that individuals who ate at least 28 grams, roughly one serving of whole grains a day, reduced their overall risk of dying during the study period by 5% and their risk of dying from cardiovascular disease 9%. Those who replaced one daily serving of red meat with a serving of whole grains reduced their mortality nearly 20%. It's unclear what dose of whole grains is most beneficial, but the current evidence suggests the more the better. This is unbelievably irresponsible journalism because first we have this paragraph suggesting a mechanism. Then we have this paragraph that says we pretty much just asked a bunch of people what they eat over the course of 25 years and saw how many of them died. And then we jump back to what is the dose that's most appropriate for these people. So anytime there's one of those, they did a study or a study showed, you have to ask yourself, are we looking at an actual biological mechanism where they actually identify a way, for example, what we know about vitamin K2 and how it actually, excuse me.
Was that the baby?
That was the baby. That was my doula, actually. So where we're actually identifying a mechanism, like we know with vitamin K2 actually I don't know what the word is going to be, activates calcium receptors or something like that to actually tell the body where to lay down calcium, as in not in the soft tissues and yes, to in the bones. So we actually have a mechanism for that. When it comes to this whole grains linked to longevity thing, they literally asked a bunch of people what they ate and then figured out what they died from over the course of 25 years. That is epidemiology. That's looking at different variables present in the same pool. And that by no means proves anything about whole grains. And I talk about that a ton in my book, but I just want to impress that before I disappear for several weeks because it's so important.
It's huge. And it's also, you know, the way that they're explaining the study, that they, what did they say? They looked at the dietary habits. They don't tell you how they tracked what they were eating. And that this other article, which I think you shared it recently, that I just shared it to my Facebook wall recently too, "We Lie About What We Eat and It's Messing Up Science" was the title of the article, January 14th. And I, when I was on the cruise in South America, there was the last evening that we were there, I'd gone out to eat and, or maybe for, it was for lunch, we'd gone out to eat and I got really sick, like just couldn't keep things in my system. I wasn't vomiting, but I was very sick. And I went to the infirmary, which was not the best idea because then they wanted to quarantine me, which I thought they wanted to keep me in the infirmary. I was like, oh, heck no, I'm not staying in this hospital-looking room. I'm like, I'm going to go back to my room. But they just wanted me to stay in my room. But they asked me for a three-day dietary recall. And they were asking me, you know, if the food I ate was on the ship, because they want to know, was there a contamination issue on the ship? Like, that's a really big deal. Anytime anything happens on a ship, any medical issues, fire, anything that happens is like, I mean, it's like a tiny city, you know? So they want to know, like, is there are there bad eggs somewhere or something? Literally bad eggs. and so I was asked to do a 3-day dietary recall, and good thing Scott was sitting there with me. Not that it was like, I mean, this wasn't for a study, but this is relevant and important. I mean, if people are getting sick on a ship, like, you really want to try and find the source of it. But I did not. I was like, what did we have for lunch yesterday? You know, and he was helping me. Oh, we had this. Remember, we sat here and we went and did this. I don't think I would have remembered everything I ate, especially because I eat a lot of food, you know. So yep. For that last 3 days, especially that third day back, that was pretty tough. I mean, the only thing that made it easier is that we are creatures of habit. I mean, definitely eating at home, it would be a little bit more habitual as well. But, you know, having had the same breakfast almost every day on the ship, all that made it a little bit easier. But I think that I was like, okay, now I see exactly how flawed these can be. And I'm so in tune with what I'm eating, paying attention to it, very carefully selecting everything that I'm putting on my plate, you know, whereas not to say that other people aren't paying attention, but if you can eat everything without a reaction, or you do eat quote unquote everything, you'll easily put food on your plate. You really don't know what you're eating. You know what I mean? You put some kind of casserole or something on a cruise ship onto your plate. You don't know all of the ingredients that could be in there. So you may not know what kind of happens. So you don't even know what you ate. So besides people lying, I think they're totally unaware a lot of the time. But yeah, I think to your point about the mechanisms too, it's kind of another one with gluten, is that a lot of research has shown, and this is something that I think I detailed that in Practical Paleo, where Alessio Fasano, who does a lot of research on gluten, specifically on the gut, obviously, talks about how the gluten protein can act upon zonulin, which is an enzyme that actually unlocks some of the tight junctions in the small intestine. And there are mechanisms for that. I'm probably saying it very poorly, just like when you're trying to describe the vitamin K2. We are nutritionists. We are not researchers and scientists. We do our best to explain these things in kind of everyday terms. But, you know, that's a mechanism, and that's totally different from looking at what people they're not even looking at what people are actually eating. They're looking at what people reported to have eaten. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's like one step further in being poor data. And then beyond that, you just can't deduce what that will mean for human health. I really don't think.
And you've got all these little factors of tendencies. So mm-hmm. people who tend to eat more whole grains tend to be more engaged in, you know, mainstream health information. Mm-hmm. So perhaps they tend to eat less red meat because they've tended to believe that that's more healthy. But they're also going to yoga, walking mm-hmm. in the fresh air,
not maybe smoking.
Not sitting, not smoking, not doing drugs. Right. So it's just,
yeah,
it's just difficult.
Yeah, it doesn't say anything. And it's a shame because
it is.
You know, you're very rarely going to see even a snippet of an article like that that says grass-fed beef linked to longevity. You know what I mean? Like, you're not going to see that in an article because it's just not what happens. The dogma is too strong and there aren't enough people to pay to support that type of article, you know?
And all the people that used to eat free-range meats before the advent of the factory farming system, they're dead.
Yeah, we can't study them. We can't ask them what they ate for the last 3 days anymore.
Yeah, exactly. All righty.
Support for this podcast is provided by Dragonfly Traditions, natural, nourishing skincare with absolutely no unnecessary chemicals. It's natural nutrition for the skin. I am a huge fan of Dragonfly, from their serum to their night cream and everything else the owner Phoebe has created. Your skin will be soft and happy with Dragonfly Traditions. If you head over to dragonflytraditions.com and make a purchase of one or more of their skincare products, you can then add Balanced Bites to your shopping cart for one penny. Phoebe will then not only send you 2 free lip balms with your order, she'll also send you that penny back. Remember, that's 2 free lip balms with purchase from Dragonfly Traditions.
Let's do some questions, shall we?
We shall.
Okay. All right. So this one is from Zahra. I think that's her name is Z-A-H-R-A. I hope I got it right. And I've actually divided her question into two separate questions. She had one about prenatal vitamin testing, and she had another kind of section to the question about becoming an RD as a paleo person. And so I went ahead and moved the prenatal vitamin testing question to one of our upcoming fertility tips. So it'll be debuting not too many episodes from now. So keep an eye out for that. But this question is about becoming an RD and paleo. She says, I'm currently an intern to become an RD. I'll take my exam in June 2015. It has been a lot of training, and I started the program before I learned about paleo. What's interesting is my human nutrition professor is paleo, and he was originally a professor at CSU with Dr. Cordain. He never mentioned paleo, but he taught us from current research. I didn't know it was in line with paleo until after I graduated. That being said, it's difficult in the RD community being paleo. I was becoming very disillusioned with my new career choice that I worked so hard to achieve. I was listening to your podcast a few weeks ago on my way to my internship at the hospital where you, Liz, and I actually think she's talking about you, Diane, spoke about the ridiculous diet your father was given by an RD at the hospital. Was that you?
Indeed.
Okay. I felt so bad because per hospital regulations, I have to teach the ridiculous cardiac diet to patients. However, that day, the dietitians were all talking about how they cannot stand teaching this cardiac diet. One of the dietitians said, how can we continue to recommend these guidelines on saturated fat and cholesterol when the research does not back it up? Several of the others agreed, and they mentioned how they try and just mention eating whole foods and leave out the saturated fat recommendations. The issue in particular, in this particular hospital, and I imagine many others, is the cardiologists are the ones who determine the diet recommendations, and they stick with what the American Heart Association gives. I have a friend who's a surgical resident, and she told me not to listen to quacks with fake research. She is the expert, and she knows cholesterol and saturated fat kills. This is the
attitude. That is hilarious.
I know. And I'm thinking probably.
I'm so embarrassed for her to say that.
I'm so embarrassed for you. This is the attitude, unfortunately, in the medical community. But on the other side of that, my sister is a medical resident, and after me getting on her case to read the actual research and emailing it to her every day, she actually read it and accepts it. In fact, she's giving a presentation at her hospital based on the research on saturated fat, cholesterol, and heart disease. She says the doctors she speaks with are very open to this. I like how she completely takes credit for what I taught her, but that's another story. So I do think the tide is changing in the RD and medical community. There are more and more medical professionals that have been taught the actual research and are not so adamant about the old dogma of nutrition. I just wanted you to know that. I can't wait to see Diane in Denver coming up. I love Mediterranean paleo. So this wasn't really a question, but I did want to reference people to the discussion. I think that Diana Rogers, when she co-hosted with me, guest hosted on the Balanced Bites podcast, she is working on her RD. And she has said a lot about her experience with what she actually has to do in the hospital, with her internship and stuff like that. And I'm really encouraged to hear that medical professionals are willing to actually look at research, because quite frankly, that's never been my experience with a medical professional in my life. Generally bringing up studies or handing them something or asking them about methodology does not yield a positive response. But I do think the tide is changing a little bit. And what I wanted to bring up with you, Diane, is whether or not you have a script that you give people to talk to their practitioners about this type of thing, or if you're just kind of like, it'll change when it changes.
I don't, but that's a really good question. Maybe we should do that.
I'm curious.
Like a script with a few specific links, you know, to some research where, you know, it's like kind of cutting through the noise and just like really, really getting down to it.
I'm kind of wondering what Zara was aggressively sending to her sister day after day after day.
Yeah. I don't know.
That she finally read. And because you think you compile this stuff in Practical Paleo or Eat the Yolks, you feel like you've put it all together, but that might be too much information.
Yeah. I mean, when I talked about it in Practical Paleo, it's really in very basic common sense terms, because I am not the person who wants to try and send somebody studies, because I feel like those, I, or this is really the truth of the matter, is those people will be swayed by whatever studies say, quote unquote, studies show, because they believed it in the first place, which we all did. But when common sense was presented to them, what's natural whole food is presented, and logic around what should be considered fit for human consumption and what should not, and what makes sense about, like, do we really think that these foods that we've eaten for thousands of years are promoting disease? If somebody is, like, so disconnected from that, I have no interest in trying to convince them of something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm okay if somebody's like, you know, if there's a specific medication that someone has to be on for a certain period of time for some reason, and the doctor says, don't eat lots of green leafy vegetables because this is Coumadin, for example. It's like a blood thinning drug. And there are some people who, you know, they have something going on, and or maybe they're older, they have a heart condition, and they're put on this drug. And it doesn't mean that I think the drug is okay or not okay. This is a specific example where they might say, you know, try not to eat too much vitamin K, because we know here's a mechanism that vitamin, that nutrient, does support blood clotting. Now, it supports blood clotting for good, healthy reasons. That's normal, a normal, healthy response to that nutrient. But for somebody who's dealing with a condition that we don't want excess of that to happen, they have a condition where too much of that may not be great, I think that type of recommendation kind of makes sense. But even when we have someone who already has impaired kidney function and we say, please don't eat excess protein, you know, because their kidney function is already impaired. But if somebody believes that eating real whole foods has caused disease, there's a huge disconnect for me in just the way that their brain works that I can't even get into it. You know what I mean? I'm like, I cannot speak to you. We're on another planet. Like, I'm on a different planet.
It's just so unfortunate that people who are bound, that are in the hospital, that can't get out, are not even being presented with more than one source of information. I think that's a huge problem.
Oh, there's so much red tape around that too. Like, they can't get real food.
What's that word? Like not unilateral, but like this tunnel that you just get the one option.
Myopic.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Whoa, you really are pregnant.
I know.
You're a word girl.
I love words. That's bad.
No, it's true. And I think, what was the other thing I was going to say on that? So the weird thing is about health and nutrition and medicine and all of this stuff as related, medical doctors somehow, not all of them, but a lot of them end up thinking and believing that they know more about nutrition and human health than they really do. So for example, you know, you walk into a mechanic and they're trained in how to fix your car. And, you know, we don't pretend to know more than they do because that's what they are trained in. But somehow, because doctors work with the human body and food is fuel for the human body, it would almost be like expecting the mechanic to also be an expert in every molecular breakdown of gasoline, oil, any kind of fluids, where they may not be. If that's not what they studied, exactly how this particular type of gasoline works or does not work in a car, just because they're a mechanic doesn't mean they understand that chemistry, because it's a different thing to study. Now, they could. There are plenty of doctors who probably do know full well the truth about nutrition and how it works. But I think there's just like this, I don't know if it's an ego or an expectation of themselves that they should know, even though they haven't been taught.
People do expect doctors to know absolutely everything.
Yeah,
and that's
about
not
everything.
Fair.
Yeah, they're just people who went to medical school.
Yep,
and they learned this one set of curriculum, and that's what they learned. And no disrespect to that; it's extremely difficult, and they learned what they learned, you know, for good reason. But I do think that it's just a shame that there's not more human biochemistry and nutrition taught to doctors, because it's the foundation of what they should be, you know, what they should be looking at with folks. And the problem is that once dis-ease is in place, blaming the whole foods and pointing people away from things that are very nutritious is just, it's fear-mongering, and it's, I don't like it. I don't respect it.
I have a lot of medical textbooks just kind of lying around because, you know, pleasure reading. But
beach reading.
Yeah, exactly. So what I notice is exactly what I talked about at the beginning of this podcast. Most of the evidence presented in these textbooks is actually epidemiology, mm-hmm. as far as even they suggest these causative mechanisms, but then they prove them with epidemiology. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge issue. And it's generally actually phrased kind of like, we don't really know, but
yeah,
this is what it appears to be. And cholesterol is a proxy for heart, you know? And so really it's not even written that definitively, but
I think the reason why so much of this is very nebulous is that food has changed so much in the last 100 years,
mm-hmm.
and human biology has not. And I think that like what they can prove as a cause-effect relationship is not that much.
You mean my digestive system did not change with the advent of Twinkies? Doubt it.
It did not. But so I think that when you look at like what's been studied about anatomy, right? Like anatomy has been the same for a very long time. There are facts about that. And I think
there are facts about
your gallbladder and where it is. And this is your liver and what it does. You know, no, truthfully, like, a lot of that stuff is fact. It's like, this is where it is. This is what it does. It makes this, you know, makes this enzyme, and that enzyme acts upon this molecule, and here's what happens. And I think that the study of food in the body is just not black and white. And it's certainly not black and white. There are even more shades, more than 50. There are even more shades of gray on how foods work in our bodies the further along we get in having different sort of gut bacterial setups, different nutrient status, you know, setups when we're born, whatever happened with our mom's nutrition. I think the further we get away from traditional foods that, you know, our great grandparents ate and even before, and how maybe, you know, for hundreds of years, human health was pretty similar. Maybe, you know, the foods that were available were all, there was no new food. There was not like a Go-Gurt and a Pop-Tart, and this stuff wasn't being introduced. It was like either you grew it or you killed it and you ate it, or that was it. Like there wasn't some grocery store with a million brightly colored boxes of new things all the time. And so not only has our constitution changed over all these years, our gut health has changed because of the advent of antibiotics, and we're killing off all this bacteria, you know, for good reasons too. We probably lived a lot longer, yeah, but I just think like so much has changed with the way that food works in the body for anybody, even for us. You know, we almost never say something definitively. We're like, oh, this definitely causes this. We know that things that can promote issues in lots of different people and what we see and say, try this, try that. But I think that it's just almost impossible to know the truth. And I think that's even true of paleo. Like mm-hmm. I've said it a million times. I don't think that eating grains is killing everybody. You know, I think there are a lot of people who don't do well with them for a lot of different reasons. And I don't think that they're the ideal food to eat for a lot of reasons. But I'm not going to ever stand in front of people and say, if you eat bread, like you're sick and that's a problem. Like I just yeah. could never say that with certainty because I just don't think it's true. So I just went on a rant.
I loved it.
About that.
To assume that knowledge has just stopped accumulating.
Right. And for ridiculous. Anyone to assume that they are right and, you know, it is factual that this does this. It's just, it's a very small-minded way of thinking to assume that you know everything because you know anything. And
dang, right. We got some shareables. We need some infographics with some quotes.
But where have I seen, I've seen this recently where it's like, the more you know you don't know.
Pretty much.
Right.
And which so it's is like a huge crisis of conscious, or it has been for me, where the farther we get along and further we yes. get along in doing this podcast, it's like, wow, we really don't know that much. We can only do the best we can with the information we actually have.
Right. And we make good recommendations based on what we've seen works for ourselves, for other people, for our clients, you know, but when there are those cases where someone's like, I tried all of these things and they're not working, it's like, well, I don't know. You know, yeah. what's going on in your body? Everyone's got something different kind of in there happening. So, yeah. And I guess this was a while ago because she was looking forward to seeing me in Denver. I hope we met.
Did you know, by the way, speaking of 50 Shades of Grey, which I have not read or seen.
Nope.
But that girl in it is the daughter of Don Johnson and Melanie Griffith.
Stop it.
I'm for serious.
I didn't know.
She was in a really cute show. She was in a really cute show called like Ben and Kate or something, which was just this delightful little family friendly show. Oh. And it got canceled, of course.
And she's like, forget that. I'm filming this movie.
Nudité.
I feel like that book came out. Let me see when it came out. I feel like it came out not too long before. Yeah, it came out like several months before Practical Paleo. So I remember when Practical Paleo released, looking at like the top, you know, 20 or 30 books on Amazon. Because Practical Paleo was up like maybe number 13 of all books. And I was like, holy cow. And I'm like, what's above it? And I was like, that darn 50 Shades of Grey, like, won't budge. You know, it was like.
You should have put way more nudity in Practical
Paleo. Obviously.
Goodness gracious. All right. Next question. Loose leaf tea versus pre-bagged. Emily says, you've both talked a lot about the benefits of herbal tea, especially when sick or detoxing. All of the brands you recommend, however, are pre-bagged. What do you think about loose leaf tea? I would think that loose leaf tea would be better nutritionally, but I'm curious to hear your opinion. I myself am a huge tea snob and much prefer the taste of loose leaf tea that I steep in a tea infuser. To me, bagged tea is often too strong and generally less fresh tasting. Is there any benefit to either one nutritionally? Thanks for all that you do. I've learned so much about nutrition, health, and even life from you both. Diane, it was great to meet you when you came to Portland for the Med Paleo Tour. And Liz, I hope I get to meet you someday too. Thanks so much. I think loose leaf tea is, it tastes better. I do, my pregnancy tea is a big old bag of loose leaf tea, but that's just not, people who are new to tea and your nudity, people who are nudity. Wow. People who are new to drinking tea generally aren't willing to buy a huge bag of tea. I would say, right?
Yeah. When I lived in San Francisco, we had a really awesome organic co-op, the hippie co-op.
Of course he did.
And when I first went paleo, it was funny because the thing that was like a great draw for the co-op was that it had all these bulk bins, which when I went in there and I was not eating grains, I was like, well, 90% of this is no longer interesting because it's all these grains. But then when I actually like, you know, scoped it out and started checking out the spices and then found loose leaf teas. Yeah. I don't know. There is something kind of fresh about it and very enjoyable, but I mean, you can't guarantee that it's more fresh or fresher. You can't
fresh. More fresher,
more most fresh, most fresh. You can't guarantee that it's fresher just because it's loose leaf. I mean, hopefully it's turning over quickly wherever you're buying it. In that bulk way. But the company that I recommend most of the time is Traditional Medicinals, and I'm actually on their website. And there's a question on their website, what are your bags made of? And it says, like you, we're concerned about what goes into our bodies and into the ecosystem. That's why our unbleached tea bags are made from a combination of wood pulp and abaca, Musa textilis, I don't know what that means. Oh, also known as Manila hemp. The tea bags are attached with a food-grade aluminum staple wire to tea bag string made of raw cotton and a paper tea bag. The tea bags are naturally gluten-free and do not contain plastics. So I thought that was good to know. And then why they're all wrapped and sealed, they say, we've done our part to formulate high-quality teas. We want to make sure your tea is reliable when you're ready to brew it. And they also say part of it is just protecting it from oxidation. So I could see this. Listen, have you been in my tea cabinet? I probably have 20 kinds of tea in there, and I'll go through phases where I'm like really into one and then I definitely don't finish the box. And I can see how if I had a million loose leaf teas, just like if you have nuts and seeds, for example, there's something, just having natural oils in the plant at all will make it prone to oxidation. So over time, not only could it spoil, but it might lose freshness and taste. And so having it wrapped would prevent that from happening. I know that Traditional Medicinals, I don't think they're all wrapped in plastic. I think they're wrapped in some kind of, they say, tamper evident oxygen and moisture barrier sealed over wrap. I think it's like a papery waxy type of parchment wrapping. And so it does keep it from air, light, humidity, and any negative impact of that on the dried tea. So I don't know. I mean, I don't have no problem. I think loose leaf tea is great, but I wouldn't be so freaked out by individually wrapped teas. I think it's fine.
Tea snobs already get it. They got it under control. They don't need our help.
Yeah. I mean, I like how cute it is to have that little like mesh metal tea ball thing and like scoop it up, and like that's kind of fun to steep it yourself like that.
It's a nice little ritual.
But yeah.
Alrighty. Next up from Grace. Hi, ladies. Thanks for putting on such a great show. I look forward to it every week. Quick question. I suspect I grind my teeth at night because my teeth and jaw are sore, and there's nothing my dentist can find wrong with them. I do have larger gums than normal. I'm really curious what that means. But my dentist said this could be natural, just from big healthy teeth, or from grinding my teeth in my sleep and impacting the bone. Either way, I don't like the idea of sleeping with a mouthful of plastic if I opt for a night guard, which is the conventional solution. Do you have any strategies to stop clenching or grinding, or do you know of any alternative to the plastic night guard? Thanks. All right, you picked this one?
I picked it.
So I'm curious.
So I basically just wanted to give my two cents on this. I'm trying to actually see it in here. I don't see it where it is in our little – oh, here we go. I just wanted to throw out my experience with this because I have had Invisalign for quite some time. It's been probably a year and a half on and off. I had a period of time where we thought it was finished, but it wasn't. And essentially what that means is every night I sleep with these plastic retainers to keep my teeth lined up. And I do find that in the morning, I think I was clenching my teeth like pretty much all night. And I feel now when if I fall asleep for a nap and I forget to have them in, or if I'm like on an airplane and I fall asleep, or if I'm starting to fall asleep at night, I'm feeling uncomfortable if I don't have them in, because I notice my teeth like almost pushing together forcefully more so than I think they should. So I don't really know that there's a huge negative impact of the plastic night guard. I also don't know that there's an alternative. So she's asking for this, but I've definitely thought a lot about this because here I am, you know, thinking, okay, what am I going to do? I think, you know, I may end up with some permanent retainers so that I don't have to wear them every night, but I actually kind of like the way it feels because I feel like it's keeping me from doing that grinding. The other thing is, at some point in time, I'm trying to see if she says why she thinks she's grinding her teeth. I think the only other issue there is getting to the root of why you're clenching or grinding your teeth, you know, and is it stress? Because it's probably stress, and, you know, working to reduce that, which is definitely something that I've been working on myself for, you know, the past couple years. Yeah, but I definitely don't have a specific other. Oh, Siri just started recording me. I don't have a specific other recommendation. My phone somehow started recording, and I looked at my phone. It says negative impact. Also, don't know if there's an alternative. I'm like, wait, that was me talking. Siri, she's so sneaky.
So
I don't know. So I don't know about alternatives, but I'm also not sure that I'd be super worried about the night guard that they give you. I don't know what it's made of compared to what the Invisalign's made of. But the other strategies, I mean, a lot of it would probably have to do with stress relief and reduction throughout your day and your week, and kind of finding ways to maybe like a guided meditation to listen to and get some relaxation going. And maybe you even do that like right before bed, and maybe just changing up your nighttime rituals and kind of getting some stress relief during the day. What do you think?
What about chiropractic adjustments? Well,
I think chiropractic adjustments are good for everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Just to reset your nervous system.
Man, I found a great chiropractor after like 7 totally failed. Because you really do have to, it's like doctors. Like you really do have to find the person that does a great job. medical doctors. You have to look. Like, you really can't just stop with the first one unless you feel like amazingly comfortable.
Unless it's Scott. You could stop with the first one.
Well, obviously. I'm saying if you could fly him in to Missouri, that would be great. But I guess around here, it's probably like the choices are a little more slim. But anyway, so the only other thing I would say is, besides exploring maybe some chiropractic adjustment, look into like neurokinetic therapy, which I don't know a whole lot about, but I'm kind of getting a little bit more into it lately just because my little sister-in-law is having some issues with her hip and running and stuff like that. She's in high school, and I'm really curious about movement patterns and different points at different places in the body that can affect that, because I certainly had some issues with TMJ at the beginning of my pregnancy and ended up needing to modify some movement patterns like in the pelvis and things like that to correct it. It was a pretty miserable time there for at least a good week or so. So I don't know all that much about it, but you could certainly Google neurokinetic therapy, teeth grinding, and see what pops up.
Yeah, I had a friend who's a practitioner in that.
Cool.
It's interesting stuff. And they find movement patterns, like you were saying, that seem totally unrelated in your body. And you're like, oh, you mean my right arm is making my left leg not work right because of how I sit at my desk? And it seems to make no sense, but...
And they look at scarring and stuff like that, like from surgeries and things like that, as to... it's fascinating.
Yeah, they can help find the source of tension in the body that's kind of like making you not move properly. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, very. Now, if we could just fix my husband's snoring, that would be great.
Ugh.
That's next. It's so funny. I can sit here and answer questions, but like the guy that sleeps next to me, I'm like, you need to figure that out.
yeah, I yes.
Yes. Okay. Wow, we are already at like 55 minutes.
We're in it. Yeah, so.
So let's wrap that up.
Yeah.
We'd like to thank Vital Choice for supporting our podcast today, and we encourage you to visit their online store at vitalchoice.com. You'll find an amazing array of some of the world's best seafood, including wild Alaskan salmon, halibut, tuna, and cod, as well as sustainably harvested shellfish. These foods are not only delicious, but vital choices for your health. You'll also find grass-fed organic Wagyu beef, live fermented foods to promote gut health, wild organic blueberries, and dark organic chocolates. Eat better, think better, and feel better with deeply nourishing foods from Vital Choice. They're offering our listeners 15% off any order using code BALANCEDBITES. Remember that orders of $99 or more ship free. So Diane, do you have a kitchen tip for us this week?
I am going to give you a couple of tips, and it's starting to get to be so many kitchen tips in that I forget what we previously talked about.
Refreshers are good.
Okay. So I'm going to, where'd my stuff go?
I just took stuff out of the stuff. Google Doc. I didn't mean to.
I am going to talk about hard-boiled eggs. I get a lot of questions about, you know, how do I boil them? How do I peel them? And why do mine not have that green ring around the outside? And so here's my advice on hard-boiled eggs. A big question that people have is whether you should boil the water first and drop the eggs in, or bring the water to a boil with the eggs in it. I have made them both ways for many, many years. I currently find that boiling the water first is just a better approach. I think that you'll bring the water to temperature faster, and the time that you boil the eggs for is generally anywhere between 8 and 10 minutes. 8 will give you much softer boiled eggs, and 10 is a hard boiled egg. And I would say 9 would be a medium. So if you're trying to get the water to boil, but you have cold eggs in it, it's just going to take a lot longer to get to boiling. So I think you just want to get that water boiling first and then gently drop the eggs in. What I tend to do before I put the eggs in is put them in just hot water from the sink so that the egg itself can start to raise in temperature. And I think that that tends to reduce how often I get eggs cracking when they just are initially placed into the water. And when I place them into the water, I use a large metal mesh strainer spoon thing. So I have one that You could use one that looks like you would use to stir fry vegetables. I don't know. This other one that I have looks like a, I don't know, it's like a 4 to 5 inch round sort of flat spoon with holes. I have no idea what it's for or where it came from. I probably stole it from my parents' house like years ago. But I'll put, you know, 3 eggs on that and just gently lower that into the boiling water, 3 at a time, however many I'm boiling. So that's what I do. And I try and just take the chill off the eggs before I'm dropping them in there. Because as you know, anytime you change temperatures of things very quickly, that's when you run the risk of, you know, if you dump boiling hot broth into a glass jar that's cold, you might shatter that glass. So there's that.
That's what happened to the, I bet that's something to do with what, why my Pyrex dish shattered.
The temperature, sorry. was it cold and you put it in the oven?
Well, no, I was taking it out of the oven. It had been at 350 for like 35 minutes and I took it out and maybe there was just a drastic temperature drop when I took it out.
Maybe, but those are supposed to withstand freezer to oven. Those are
Pyrex.
I think they're really made to withstand that. I mean, but I've seen a lot of them exploding. So here's the other thing. When you finish boiling the eggs, have a bowl of ice water ready. And if you want to get the water really extra cold, you can put some salt into the water. That'll help chill down the water even faster. But have ice water ready and remove the eggs from the boiling water with that same slotted spoon and place them into the ice bath, just like you would do with vegetables that you're shocking, where you want them to stop cooking and stop turning darker green and then brown. You want to keep them bright green. You do this with eggs as well. Instead of letting them sit and just keep cooking because they stay hot, which is what you'll see if you get any hard-boiled eggs at a buffet, for example, on a cruise ship, they'll always have that dark greenish ring around them because they have just cooked for way too long. So just put them in the ice bath. They'll stop cooking. They'll be perfect. And for easier peeling, a couple of things I can recommend. I've seen a million recommendations on this as well, but I'm just like, I can't think that hard about it. Two things. One, don't use fresh eggs. So if you're hard boiling eggs, if you have to use fresh ones because that's all you have and you're just boiling them to take you with you somewhere and you don't have a choice, okay, but they're going to be harder to peel. If you use eggs that you've had in your fridge sitting around for a minimum of a week, even longer, they're going to be easier to peel when you're done. The shell won't be as delicate and like come apart in tiny little shards like it does when they're fresher. And then what I tend to do is I'll, on the countertop, I'll just kind of like crack the shell almost all around or in a lot of areas, not just in one small area. And I tend to peel them under running water. I don't know if it's my imagination, but I feel like they're just easier to peel. If the water is running, you can get a little lift under that film that's under the shell. And get some water in there and I just rinse them off and that all the excess shells that are kind of peeling, the little pieces are just easier to kind of let them run away with the water that's running. So those are my tips and that's what I do. And you can store them already peeled in an airtight container for several days in the fridge, maybe up to a week. I think that they're easiest to peel when they're still warm. So that's something I would recommend after they sit in that ice bath for a few minutes. I would peel them all if you can.
So all maybe right. Instead of doing my own tip, maybe I'll just add a little addendum to your cooking tip.
Okay.
All right. So I remember Haley from Health Starts in the Kitchen. Mm-hmm. She raises chickens and turkeys and all that good stuff. And she said at one point, and this may only apply to people who are getting fresh eggs like direct from the farmer, mm-hmm. because I don't know whether this applies to refrigerated eggs.
I'm sure she never buys grocery store eggs.
Oh, never, never, never. I mean, she's got a phenomenal setup. So I know that if I have, for example, I've been making hard-boiled duck eggs lately. I steam them for 16 minutes and then put them in ice water. So what you do is if you take the very fresh eggs, like you said, they won't peel if you take fresh eggs and then hard-boil them right away. But if you leave them out for a few days on the countertop, that's like aging them, like several weeks. So I'll leave the eggs out that I've collected freshly on the counter for a couple of days, and then I'll hard boil them or hard steam them, and it totally works. So something about aging them.
Duck eggs that you've rinsed or not rinsed? Like
I have not rinsed them. So but I thought that
you were – sorry, go ahead.
No, I don't know how that would work. I know with my fresh eggs, right. I gather them. I never refrigerate them. I let them sit for a couple of days before I hard boil them. But I don't know how that would work for eggs that have been washed and refrigerated and sold.
I do not either.
I don't know. Because I know once you wash them, you do take off a little, that protective film. So maybe Haley from Health Starts in the Kitchen can elaborate on that a little bit more. But it does work with fresh eggs.
Go follow her on Instagram.
She's got a book coming out.
She does, eventually. Without Grain?
Yeah.
I'm trying to look up her account on Instagram. Health Starts in the Kitchen, just as it sounds.
Hey friends, Liz checking in with a Baby Making and Beyond tip of the week here, per usual, with my BMB partner, Meg Reburn, Meg the Midwife.
Hey.
Hey, darling. And last week we talked about the immune system during pregnancy and a few basic ideas to support it. Today's tip is about a very specific kind of movement that you maybe should actually avoid during pregnancy. Of course, remember, we're not doctors, nor are we giving medical advice or offering diagnoses or treatment. This is just information that you can take to your healthcare provider. So in the Baby Making Beyond program, we're going to have a ton of information on proper movement for a good, strong pelvic floor. And of course, why that's important. But right now, I want to talk about something that pregnant women are constantly told to do, and that's to walk. Most practitioners do not understand that walking is not walking is not walking. So walking on a treadmill actually changes the biomechanical impact of the act of walking. While, you know, motion, of course, is a good thing, when we're talking about pregnancy and what we're trying to accomplish by walking, it actually does not benefit your pelvic floor the way walking outside or on a non-moving belt does. So if you're relying 100% on a treadmill for your walking, look for another way if you can. If it's winter though, and that was my biggest challenge, if it's winter and I was pregnant through the winter, so I get it, on like in a very, very windy, cold part of the country, it's difficult. You can actually try to look for like a local community center, because they often have tracks in their buildings. A lot of gyms don't have tracks anymore, but a lot of community centers do, and they'll let you walk for free. They will let pregnant ladies come in and just walk the track for free. So grab like an audiobook, put the headphones in, and actually walk physically somewhere and not on a treadmill as much as possible.
Yeah.
Do you have some tips about walking outside, since you're the adventurer, outside adventurer?
Well, I live in a place where it has about 9 months of winter. So I know all about walking in the cold and walking outside on uneven ground. And I care for lots of pregnant mamas out here, and I tell you, they walk everywhere. So, I mean, most important thing if you're walking in the winter and you want to be outside is get some of these little, I think they're called yak tracks, or a couple of different companies make them, but they're little covers that go over your boots that have little spiky things on them, so that you don't have a little slip and fall. So they'll give you some traction in the winter time. You can also put a couple of those little hot pockets in your mitts to keep your hands warm as you walk around. The other thing you can do, I mean, there's community centers, just like you mentioned, Liz, but you could just go to the mall and walk.
This is nothing wrong with,
you know, if you live in a place where it's just, you just absolutely cannot be outside, or you just don't want to be cold, just go walk around the mall. There's nothing wrong with that.
We see geriatrics doing it all the time.
And those are the same people that also go to Aquasize, right?
Yeah.
Geriatrics and pregnant women. That's another option. It's some good water aerobics.
Form some good multi-generational bonds.
That's right.
All walking.
But yeah, walking in the winter, if you want to do it outside, get some spiky things on your feet. Walking is the best thing you can do for your pregnancy and postpartum too.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that's it. That's our Baby Making and Beyond tip of the week. Hop over to babymakingandbeyond.com to sign up for program alerts, and we'll talk to you next time. We're done for the week then. So you can find Diane at dianesanfilippo.com. You can join me at realfoodliz.com and join our email list for free goodies. While you're on the internet, leave us an iTunes review. We'd greatly appreciate it. We will, or Diane and some combination of other person. We'll see you next week.